Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. I'm the Porkmeister. You are listening to Life on Planet Porky, and of course, the main character, or the main character, I should say, within the chapters of adventures that we bring you from Planet Porky is, of course, the rock chick writer herself, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. You may have heard her giggling there just now. She's a bit of a giggler, old Leslie Ann. Miss Jones, how are you this fine day?
I'm absolutely fine, Michael. Thank you very much for asking.
That's fine, no problem.
You've been having some adventures, though, haven't you?
I don't know where to start. I made a mistake a few weeks ago about the Scottish national team by underrating it in terms of how many Premier League players play for it, because I come from the era, actually touched on this in one of the previous podcasts, I come from the era of Dennis Law and Ian St John and Alex Young, the Golden Vision, all that kind of stuff. I didn't give Scotland the due praise and credit they deserve for having so many players in the English Premier League. And funnily enough, 2 days after I said all that on the Jeremy Vine show, a statue was unveiled in Aberdeen for Dennis Law, who I think is one of the greatest ever, to be honest. And it was marvellous to see a statue. So I made my amends. I got a kilt sent to me by a fine kilt maker in Scotland called McGregor and Macduff. Thank you very much indeed to them for helping me out there. I hope I got that right.
I'm sure it wasn't Ben Doon and Phil McCavity.
Oh, no, come on, Miss Jones, for goodness sake. A, we are a family show. And
that's
B,
just names, right? That is just names.
And B, right, we are not going to, you know, sort of start taking the mickey out of all things Scottish. It's outrageous.
I'm not taking the mickey. I wouldn't dream of taking the mickey.
I would hope not as well.
So what happened next?
Hang on, I hope they've got the name of the...
I'm feeding you the lines here.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just checking that I've told you properly the name of the kilt makers. Here we go. The kilt makers were, yes, McGregor and Macduff. I hope I said that the first time round. Based in Glasgow, and they send kilts out all over the world. Well, the issue and the problem was this, that I got to the studios this morning, and there was a box sent down from Glasgow with the kilt in, beautiful kilt, pair of kilt socks, so to speak, and a sporran.
A sporran.
See, there you are again.
I'm just trying to say it properly. Because you didn't say it properly, so I thought I'd have a go. But it's quite hard to say that word, isn't it?
Anyway, so I've never worn a kilt before, and I put the kilt on. By the way, do you know that when you're measured for a kilt, you're not measured on your waist size, you're measured...
Hang on, slow. Family show.
No, come on. You're measured... For goodness sake, Miss Jones, you turn everything to a lewd interpretation, don't you?
Lewd.
Lewd. It's a bit lewd.
How do you spell that exactly?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. You actually are measured around your navel, right? Not your waist. So I'd give
Your navel's only about an inch.
Well,
circumference, isn't it?
I don't know.
I'm joking.
The navel part of your stomach, not your hip.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah, right.
Got it.
So anyway, I'm in the dressing room and I struggle into the kilt. You had to pull it over your waist, get to your navel, that kind of thing. Put all the belts in place, put my sporran on and all that. And unfortunately, I shouldn't be laughing here because it's shocking. I walked onto the set. And one of the people who I work with at Jeremy Vine is a wonderful lady called Storm Huntley. She's Jeremy's assistant, did a brilliant job. I think she's a great, great broadcaster. And her face immediately dropped. And I thought, I wonder what the problem is there. And she noticed I'd put the kilt on the wrong way round.
Oh, no, Dr. Finlay. That's gruesome.
God, that's shocking, honestly. I mean, you mustn't do these things like this.
Don't you remember that joke?
I remember Dr. Finlay. What was the rest of the joke? Sorry.
Yeah, so the joke goes, Janet, put your hand up my kilt. Oh, no, doctor, it's gruesome. Janet, I said, put your hand up my kilt. Mm. Oh, no, doctor, it's gruesome more.
Oh, dear me. I mean, Miss Joan, come on. A, I am not getting into anything like that to, you know, attack the Scottish nation or patronise the Scots and all that. I did this as a serious attempt to apologise.
Yeah, but that's not the offensive bit, putting the kilt on the wrong way round. You do know that, don't you?
What do you mean?
It's extremely offensive to Scots for non-Scots to wear kilts at all. Well, you have to be from there, or you have to have family ancestors from the Highlands to be allowed to wear the national dress. Otherwise, this is cultural appropriation. It has deep historical roots, and you're not allowed to do it.
Listen, it's St Andrew's Day I did this on, right? And I was doing it as a tribute to the Scots, an apology for...
but you're not Scot.
Well, I've got some Gaelic ancestry somewhere because I was brought up in Chester, just across the border from Wales. I've got a Welsh name, Parry, as I'm sure you...
Well, that's nothing to do with the Scots,
well,
is
it's
it?
Gaelic. It's Gaelic.
Welsh.
It's Gaelic.
Gaelic.
And,
we say Gaelic, yes.
And anyway, look, I don't think I can be blamed for putting the kilt on the wrong way around because I've never...
Did you keep your legs closed?
Oh, well, I'm not getting into this, Miss Jones. I think we'll move on and talk about something else, you know, that you can take rather more seriously, okay? So, yes, we'll move on from there. I tell you what, I do want to talk about something really cultural, and you'll know all about this that I don't. Are you aware of a painting called A Bar at the Folies Bergères, is it?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. This is Edward Manet's, his most famous painting.
That's it.
It's at Somerset House, isn't it? In the Courtauld Gallery.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
It was his final major work, painted around 1882, I think, in Paris. It's a realist painting.
Yeah.
The perspective is a little bit out. I don't know if you've ever looked at it.
It's meant to be. I saw this huge feature on this painting, and I've seen images.
Oh, did you? Where was that?
Hey.
Where was it?
What?
The feature.
Oh, I don't know, in the Telegraph or something, or magazine or something like that. And, you know, I've seen images of this painting before, never really looked at it. I didn't realise, A, it's a mirror reflection sort of painting and all that. Mm. But
it's beautiful, isn't it?
It is beautiful. When you look into the detail of what it's all about, the lady behind the bar is probably a lady of the night as well as a barmaid. It's speculated that Manet himself, the brilliant, was he an impressionist?
Not really. No, he was a realist.
Oh, a realist. Okay, yeah. He made.
You're thinking of Monet. Monet was an impressionist.
Monet and Manet. I always get them mixed up. When I was living in New York, there was a Monet, as opposed to Manet, that this painting was painted by. There was a Monet exhibition at the museum, the New York Museum of Metropolitan Art, I think it is. And the queues were 4 miles down the streets of Manhattan for people to get in. They don't half like the French paintings, you know.
They do. Well, yeah. Yeah, because it's a part of culture that they really don't have because their nation is only a couple of hundred years old, isn't it?
But, yes.
And that I do understand. But the most interesting feature of that painting is a bottle of Bass Pale Ale.
Yes, that's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, go on.
Yeah, and you know why? This was considered to be a sign of anti-German sentiment after the Franco-Prussian War, as normally at the Folies Bergères, you wouldn't be selling English beer, you'd be selling German beer.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was made as a statement, which was quite a daring thing to do at that time.
It was said to be the first ever product placement incident in history because you're quite right, that bottle of beer brewed in Burton-on-Trent with a red triangle on the label. The oranges apparently signify something else as well. Something about, you know, I don't know, some signal to somebody about Protestants or something like that. I don't know. But, you know, I've looked at the painting. I thought, wow, I've got to go and see the real thing. So on our next trip to Fleet Street, Miss Jones, I don't think that Somerset House is very far away from there, is it?
Oh, yeah, let's do a detour.
Yeah.
But I tell you what we won't do at Somerset House. We won't go skating.
No, they'll have a skating rink there, will they, this year?
Yeah, they do. I usually take my kids to it.
Oh, yeah.
But my son's in Panto. Oh, yes, he is. So he only gets one day off for Christmas, so we can't do it this year. And it wouldn't be the same if we didn't all go, you know.
So
we're not doing that this year. But, yeah, let's go and look at that because it really is. Mm. I tell you one thing. When we were all sort of late teenagers, that painting inspired a fashion among all of us young girls.
Yeah.
We started wearing chokers with big brooches in the middle.
Oh, right, yeah.
Like the barmaid is wearing in the painting.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, how wonderful that is. Anyway, look, you've just mentioned Christmas. We haven't spoken about Christmas yet, and we're only 3 weeks away. And do you know what, Miss Jones? It doesn't feel like Christmas to me. I don't know why. I've been waiting for it for so long after it didn't come last year, but I am absolutely shrugging my shoulders at anything Christmassy at the moment. Why is that?
It's because we're not kids anymore, really. I mean, you know, the whole meaning of Christmas is lost on most people. It's just a festival of greed and overspending.
Yes.
And the fact that we had to do without the usual Christmas last year, I think has made a lot of us think differently about it.
Yeah.
You know, we're thinking about instead loan sharks being out there preying on people, credit card companies, people getting into massive debt to furnish their families with stuff they can't afford.
Yes.
And really, we're not celebrating the birth of Christ, the arrival of Christianity on earth, are we? Not most people are not. There's no Father Christmas. We know that. Sorry, kids, but, you know, once that's gone, that magic of Christmas has gone. Really, it's just a spend feast, isn't it, to be honest?
Well, it's still, you'd have thought after last year when none of us could get together, I had to abandon my trip to Bournemouth on Christmas Day in isolation here. Didn't mind that. That was okay.
But you made your dinner and you had a nice time.
Yeah, yeah, I did. And also, the world moves at such a fast pace now. I know we've been through an awful lot of lockdown, but I don't mind an occasional day when nothing happens. You know what I mean? But there we are. But I'm looking forward to it this year. Anyway,
this whole thing of presents, too many presents people get, don't they?
Oh, well, that's the thing I was going to mention to you. I read this piece, right, about Eamon Holmes, and I like Eamon a lot. I've worked with him in the past. I think he's a very genial, nice guy and all that kind of stuff. He says that early on in their relationship with his wife, Ruth, I think it is, isn't it? Second wife, I think.
Second wife, yeah. He dumped the first one for Ruth.
Oh, dear me. That sounds a bit bitter, Miss Jones, you know.
I'm not bitter. I'm not involved. I was just pointing it out.
Yes. Well, you say dumped. I mean, you know, they parted. You know, it happens to many people, including yourself. These things just happen. It shouldn't necessarily be labelled as being dumped, should it?
Well, yes, because his wife and kids were living in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And he was working in London.
Yeah.
And supposed to be going home at weekends to spend with his family. Mm. And as time ticked on and when he found somebody else, he gradually stopped going home.
Well, look, it's knock on any door and you'll find a story. And
well,
you
know, that's true.
I don't have any judgment about that. Funny enough, I worked in an organisation once when the boss lived in Ireland. And I could never get my head around the fact that, you know, he never turned up till 11 o'clock on a Monday morning and he was always away by 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. And when you're head of an organisation, if you're head of particularly a broadcasting organisation, which works 24 hours a day, I think that's a really odd arrangement and it would never have suited me. I've been head of organisations and newspapers and radio stations, and it's a 24-hour-a-day job. And even being on a plane for an hour and a half, you know, each way, and usually it's 3 or 4 hours because you've got to get to the airport and all that, I just don't know how people do it. But look, some people are better at the jobs than I was at, and if they thought they could do it in less hours, good luck to them, you know what I mean?
Well, I tell you what, it's a recipe for disaster. I went through this myself.
Right.
My ex-husband worked in Poland Monday to Friday.
Mm-hmm.
He was, the bank he was doing IT for had acquired another bank and he was making the two IT systems talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a workforce of about 6,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to go on Sunday afternoon, as soon as we'd had Sunday lunch, the big Sunday feast.
Yeah.
My little boy used to call it Poland food because no sooner had he eaten the meal than he was out the door with his suitcase to go and get on the plane
to fly
to Warsaw. And then he was gone Monday to Friday. I had a 10-year-old, a 2-year-old and a newborn baby.
Golly.
And I was doing all of that by myself while he was off swanning around Poland.
And
of course, the marriage collapsed because... Right. Frankly, you've got to be there. So any of these arrangements where people say, oh, yeah, it's fine. I'll work in London Monday to Friday and go home at weekends. Recipe for disaster. I would never advise it.
No, I totally agree. Poland's a great country, by the way. I had an investment in some property there early on and it accumulated very, very rapidly. And then I got rid of it.
By the way, what were we saying about Eamon Holmes?
Right, sorry, yeah, get back to Eamon Holmes. So about the first or second Christmas they had together, Eamon buys Ruth 5 presents for Christmas Day to put around the tree. I suppose they were probably on their own, you know. I suppose you have to in that sort of situation, you have to split your time at Christmas and New Year as to which family you go to, and which, you know, your children, all that kind of stuff, don't you? You know, but apparently they were on their own. So Eamon had 5 or 6 presents for Ruth, and she said, "Oh, I've got some for you." And she went out the room and came back with, you know, 6. And she said, "Oh, don't worry, I've got some more." She ended up buying him 62 presents.
Well, that's ludicrous. What a what a terrible, horrible waste that is. We have a rule now that my children are grown up.
Yeah.
We have a real rule. We do 4 each. And it goes like this little rhyme. Something you want, something you need, something to wear, and something to read.
Ah, that's
and
cool.
That's what we do now, because nobody needs that excess. Mm. Everybody buys what they want throughout the year anyway.
Yeah.
So presents are only a gesture. Mm. And the reason we give presents is to reflect the wise men who brought Jesus gold, frankincense, and myrrh.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. At the birth of Jesus. That's why we exchange presents, yeah.
Yeah, and we should exchange them on Boxing Day, shouldn't we? Because that's what the Victorians used to do and in Dickens' time.
Oh, well, screw them. They're dead.
Yeah, well, they are dead. You're right. I'm very generous at buying presents. I love to give people presents at Christmas. So I would always, you know, get a note from my sisters, you know, telling me what they wanted and all that. And they would then go and buy them. I hardly ever bought any of the presents. By the time I got down to Bournemouth and all the presents were wrapped around the tree, I hadn't bought any. They'd been bought for me. All I did.
That's not really the point, is it?
Well, it is, yeah, yeah.
No, it isn't. If someone prescribes what they want, they might as well just go and buy it for themselves.
Well, I then sign a cheque before I go home on the 27th or the 28th, you know, and everybody's happy. But I would always come with all sorts of stuff in my boot. I mean, 4 cases of wine, 6 boxes of Quality Street, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know,
big what's the address? I'll come round yours.
Exactly. Big boxes of crackers, all that kind of stuff, you know, Christmassy stuff. And I always brought stupid little games, you know, to, like, for instance, little electric helicopters, which you could fly around the kitchen and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
I love Christmas games. The whole thing about Christmas for me is get the meal out of the way and then play the games. And we always do things like charades. And,
yeah, right.
Oh, you know, the name game where you have the name stuck on your forehead.
On your forehead.
See it. Yeah. And everybody else has to ask you questions so that you can guess who you are.
Yeah.
I love that game. So brilliant.
Those sort of games drive me mad. But what I do is I buy things like Bagatelle or something like that, which people can play, you know. But anyway, I'm a mug for walking through a department store and buying everything in sight. But of course, there's no department stores anymore. The nearest thing to a department store now I can find in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, is a place called Wilco, and it just sells, like, you know, buckets and I mean, it's like the old-fashioned Woolworths, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, really. Would you not take a trip to Harrods? The food hall there is wonderful.
Do you know what? I can't remember the last time I was in Harrods, but it was about 25 years ago.
And really?
We went in there and went to the bar. Yeah,
exactly. It's easier just to go into a bar, surely.
Well, it was nice to say we were in the bar at Harrods, but anyway, there we are. Have you seen that picture, Miss Jones, of Mick Jagger wearing those massively oversized spectacles? What's all that about?
I'll tell you what that's about. These are spectacles called retimer glasses.
Yeah.
And they're said to help you get to sleep. They reset your body clock.
Right.
They've been developed about 35 years ago, I think, and they are the world's first wearable green-blue light therapy device.
Right.
Do you know what I reckon? I reckon this company gave them to him free to advertise them. So he puts them on and hangs over a balcony in Miami. Yeah. Loads of photographers know he's in there, so they're all hanging around outside.
Yeah.
They take pictures. Pictures are in newspapers all over the world. Job done. Free advertising.
But what's in it for Mick?
Well, he gets a pair of these glasses and he gets to go to sleep, I suppose.
Yeah, but I'd have thought...
Well, you know, he's famously parsimonious.
That's what I mean. So surely he'd have asked for a huge fee, wouldn't he, to wear those glasses?
I reckon, no, he would have just asked for about a dozen pairs.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
They cost £189, which isn't a lot, is it really?
No.
And the company tells us that up to 50% of the world's population struggles to get to sleep.
Well,
and endures fatigue as a result. I can believe that because I find it very hard to go to sleep.
Well, yeah, I do sometimes as well. The worst part for me is if I want to go to bed early, I'll go into bed early tonight because I'm working on a breakfast show tomorrow. And I get up as early as sort of 3:30, 4 o'clock. So I'll be going to bed early. That's fine. That's no problem. We're 3:30. But it means tomorrow night I'll probably still go to bed early because I'll feel tired from having been up all day tomorrow. You see what I mean? But then I wake up at 2 o'clock, 2 a.m. And I get up and I check my phone, and then I go and like check everything else, make sure all is well in the world. And then I can't for the life of me get back to sleep. And then suddenly at 5:30 a.m., I want to go to sleep and I can't because I've got to get up and do things.
Well, I think, you know, why not invest in a pair of these retimer glasses, first of all?
Well,
but I've got a cheaper solution for you,
yes,
Mr. Parry. I've been using two things recently which have really helped me.
Right.
One of which is chamomile and manuka honey tea bags from Marks and Spencer,
okay,
which you buy in a little square box.
Yeah.
And just one of those at bedtime. And that makes you quite soporific, mm-hmm, so you feel sleepy. Mm-hmm. The other thing is something you can buy in Boots, flower remedies. I don't know if you come across those.
No.
But they do a sleep spray, and you put 2 or 3 drops on your tongue.
Right.
And off you go. Sublime sleep. I slept all night since I started using
this. Really? Where'd you get that from?
Yeah, just in Boots.
In
the
Boot?
Flower remedies. They're called bark flower remedies.
Where'd you get those? Which shelf are they on?
So, you know, in the kind of pharmacy bit where they have all the vitamins and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I must remember that, actually.
Have a look there. Bark flower remedies.
Bark flower remedies. You put it on your tongue, you say?
Yeah, just to use, it's a little kind of spray thing.
Oh, okay.
And you spray a bit on.
Because
I usually have a bit more than that.
Yeah.
You know, overdose on it a bit because that's not going to kill me, is it?
No, it's not. The other one that I've been, you know, urged to use for years and years, and I've never got around to it, is putting something on your pillow. It sounds like the same sort of thing. You put it on your pillow and then it draws into your nostrils as you're trying to get to sleep and sends you to sleep. But I don't know.
Well, lavender is quite a good thing to try, but it makes you smell like an old lady.
Oh, does it? Oh, well, I don't want that.
You don't want that. Yeah. Old lady's pants. Yeah.
Oh, no, thank you. We'll move on from that one.
Moving swiftly on.
Talking about rock stars, by the way, is this Elton John and Rod Stewart feud that's been going back now 40 years, is this all made up? Because last time I saw Rod talking about it, he actually sounded quite serious about, you know, not really very much liking Elton John again.
They've always bitched. They call each other Sharon and Phyllis.
Yeah,
so Rod is
years.
Sharon and Elton's Phyllis. They all had women's names back in the day.
Right.
Freddie Mercury was Melina after Melina Mercouri, the Greek actress, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And his PA was called Phoebe, Peter Freestone. This is a common thing in that game. But, I mean, look, these two are 76 and 74. For goodness sake, get a life.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not going to live much longer. They've always had
Don't say that. You know, you're looking in the face of mortality there.
Well, we all are.
Yeah,
come on. You know, we all are.
Yeah.
But I think at that stage in the game, for goodness sake, just get over it. They fell out, I think, in about 2018, because I think Rod made some disparaging remark about Rocket Man, which was Elton John's film.
Rocket Man. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
That one. Did you see the film?
No.
I mean, it's not all that. It's a bit of a fantasy. It breaks into song every few minutes, so it's a bit La La Land.
Right.
And it's very mean to Elton's mother, who was a lovely woman. I knew her pretty well, Sheila Fairbrother.
But Elton treated her badly, didn't he, for a long
time? Yeah, he did. Yeah. And this was awful. At her 90th birthday party.
Yeah.
Because he was estranged from her, and she'd been trying for years to make up with him.
Yes.
And he's a bit bitchy, is Elton. You know, he just wouldn't draw a line under it and see his mother. And at her 90th birthday party, she had an Elton John tribute act performing.
Yes, yes.
She couldn't have the real thing. I just think that's awful.
Yeah.
I think this is probably more Elton's fault than Rod's, because Elton bears a grudge. He doesn't forget things, and he will hang on to a row, whereas Rod is much more let bygones be bygones.
Yeah,
you know, we've known each other for 50 years or so. We should just be mates.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with all of that. And also, Rod made disparaging comments about Elton's farewell tour, didn't he? He sort of hinted, well, this might be this year's farewell tour, but there'll be another farewell tour in 2 years' time. And that's happened quite a lot, hasn't it, in the showbiz world?
Oh, look, Tina Turner did about 12 farewell tours. You know, it's all about the money.
Sure.
So This is an interesting fact as well, that the vast majority of rock performers don't make most of their money from ticket sales.
Yeah.
They make it from the merchandise.
Right.
And there is so much money in the merchandise.
Golly.
That this is really why they keep going out on the road. Yeah. So they think, oh, you know, I'll do one more and then call it a day. But then they spend all that money.
Yeah.
And of course, they have huge entourages to take care of.
Yeah.
They've got all the ex-wives, all the ex-children, yeah. all the people who work for them. So they have to keep doing it
yeah.
just to keep the whole thing on the road.
Keep it on the road. I remember years and years and years ago when I was in America, we went to a Jackson's concert. So it wasn't Michael Jackson, it was the Jacksons, because about mm-hmm. once every couple of years, he had to go out on the road with his brothers just to get them some money, didn't he? You know, because they didn't have any without him.
Yeah, he was good like that.
Yeah, he was good like that. And I think it was at Carnegie Hall in New York or somewhere in New York.
I love Carnegie yeah, Hall. What a great venue that is.
Oh, brilliant. And I love the history of Mr. Carnegie, a Scots.
Andrew
Carnegie, thank you very much. A Scots. Metallurgist who went to America, invented a new way of making steel, which was one third the cost of the way steel was being made at the time, and subsequently became the richest man in the world and built every bridge in America up until the 1900s. A terrific story. But anyway.
Great story. There's that little gag, isn't there, about the lady walking down the street. And she asks the construction guy, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Mm. And he says, lady, you got to practice.
Yes, that's very good. I like that. Lovely. It's like the taxi driver who was taking me to JFK. And I said, you don't know which terminal I'm going to. You don't know where I'm going. He said, hey, buddy, when you leave in New York, you ain't going nowhere.
That's great as well.
Same sort of thing. But no, just to finish this story, the programme, even in those days, cost like $10. I mean, it was, you know, it was ridiculous because it was only just full of pictures of Michael Jackson and his brothers. But, you know, it was printed on the day of that concert. And I've still got it. Still got it somewhere, you know. So I know exactly what you mean about the merchandise. Mm-hmm.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today, us being myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, I've heard a remarkable story about your uncle, Cliff, who is, as many will know who listen to this podcast regularly, a footballing legend, a man who played in the great Spurs team of the early 60s and is so fit now, as fit as a fiddle, he can still get into the same trousers with the same waistband as he did 50 years ago. But what's this about the wedding ring?
Oh, this is a great story. And my mum said, well, they must have had a slow news day on this day that this was out. But, but it's a story about a wedding ring.
Yeah.
And this is to do with Terry Medwin, who is a former Wales and Spurs teammate of
right.
Cliff's.
Right.
And his wife,
Joyce. I remember him, actually.
Joyce,
I remember most of the great Spurs team, but I don't remember him.
Yeah, it's an obscure name, isn't it? But his wife, Joyce, was making batches of Welsh cakes, one for the Tottenham chairman, Daniel Levy, and another batch for Cliff, because he loves the Welsh cakes. So she made the cakes and she baked them and then she went to bed. And then she realized, oh goodness, my mother's wedding ring has gone off my finger. And she woke her daughter up. They went downstairs in the kitchen. They looked everywhere. They couldn't find it.
Yeah.
And she thought it was gone. And then a couple of days later, Cliff was in the kitchen with Auntie Joan eating one of the Welsh cakes. And the wedding ring turned up in his mouth.
That is amazing. That's an amazing story, honestly. Utterly fantastic because, I mean, I've never been married. I've never had a wedding ring on my finger. But you see such panic-stricken people in stories about losing their wedding ring. Women take them off and leave them, you know, in bathrooms, in hotels and all kinds of things. Or they lost them when they're cooking or they lost them when they go swimming or something. That's a great, great story. I'm surprised it hasn't had greater prominence.
Well, I'm just glad that he didn't swallow it, because
No
man goes through that for a ring.
No, absolutely. Years ago, I was on a, what we call in our business euphemistically, a facility trip to Australia.
Freebie.
And it was Western Australia. So we started off in Perth and went on there. And Western Australia is a very rugged place. When we used to fly over Western Australia, the pilot, who I got to know very well, we had our own little plane, right, to take us around, 12-seater plane, took us all over the place, because it's such a vast area, you know, it's no good getting in a coach. You wouldn't get anywhere after 6 or 10 hours, but you do if you fly for 3 or 4 hours. Anyway, point of the story is that the pilot would look down and say, do you know what, Mike, you see the ground below you? He said, no white man has ever walked on that ground. I said, what do you mean? He said, it's been inhabited by Aborigine tribes over the centuries, but no white man's ever been that far into the bush and walked there. I mean, that's how, you know, remote it is. Amazing stuff. Anyway, we got to one particular place, and we're talking now about visiting sort of canyons and that sort of stuff, which are 300 million years old, you know, which have been forged by retreating glaciers and all that kind of stuff. And they're beautiful to swim in. The water is so pure and all that kind of stuff, you know. Anyway, one of the people with us suddenly, shrieked. This is a bloke. He literally, oh, my God, what's from my wedding ring? It's gone. It'd come off his finger while he'd been swimming in the, you know, the creek, so to speak, you know. This pilot guy wasn't only a pilot. He was also a former sort of Olympic standard swimmer. For Australia. I mean, I don't think he ever swam in the Olympics, but he was like, you know, a competitive swimmer. He said, don't worry, I'll find it for you. And he dived in, and we didn't see him for, I swear, about 2 minutes. I couldn't believe it. I thought, he's drowned. And then all of a sudden, he came up, and he was holding the wedding ring. He'd found
it. No way. How did he do that?
No idea. I mean, the water's very, very clear, but we were looking down. You couldn't see down into the water more than, you know, maybe 30 or 40 feet. He actually swam to the bottom of this canyon and looked around and found it. It was
unbelievable.
Awesome. Yeah.
Wonder if it was the same one or if he just had a spare one in his back pocket.
Well, I don't think he had a spare one in his back pocket, but the guy concerned was very, very relieved, believe me. Now, old Damon Blur, okay?
Damon Blur of Albarn, you mean?
Sorry, yeah, thank you very much. Damon Albarn of Blur. I've been to his bar, by the way, in Iceland.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, he has a bar.
Has he got one of those ice bars? I've always fancied going to an ice bar.
No, he hasn't. He hasn't, actually. But he has a bar in Reykjavik, which is the capital of Iceland, okay?
Oh, I so want to go there. If ever you want to take me anywhere, take me to Reykjavik.
It's fantastic. There's two great cities in Iceland, Reykjavik and Keflavik. And Reykjavik is the capital, and it's beautiful. It's only about four streets. It's like Bond Street, Oxford Street, and whatever other great street is around there, because all the shops are just, you know, huge, high-end names, because everybody in Iceland's so wealthy, you know what I mean?
Oh, I'd love to go there. I've always wanted to go and see the Northern Lights.
Yeah, I saw the Northern Lights in Iceland.
Was it worth it? Was it cracked, what it was cracked up to be?
Well, they said to me I didn't have the greatest of nights, but it was like watching... It's not a firework display. It's like watching the sky rippling, you know, with different colours.
And did you go on a reindeer and do a sleigh ride stuff?
No. When I was there, I went there independently. I wanted to go to Iceland. I just thought, somewhere I've got to go. So I went there independently. And they organise all these trips to go driving around volcanoes. What am I going to drive around a volcano for? And all this kind of stuff. All I wanted to do was literally get into a few cocktail bars. Jorn Borg had a hotel there, and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
And did they play tennis?
No, they don't play tennis in Iceland. It's too cold. And outside my hotel, there's a lake. And between the hotel and the town centre, there's a lake. And for 8 months of the year, you can walk across the lake. It's fantastic, you know, it's frozen.
You don't want to be the one that walks across it at 8.5 months. That's and right, falls in.
Suddenly, you've gone in. But anyway, the point of this story and all that background on Damon Albarn of Blur or Blurry, he's said that he's made a mistake. He spent £1 million on a basement extension to his £6 million Notting Hill home. And he said the reason he did it was because all his neighbours around him were doing it. And he thought, crikey, if I don't keep up with the Joneses, so to speak, and build a basement in my home, my property is going to be much less in value than theirs.
Well, two things happen.
Yeah.
They get flooded. The basements all get flooded and they ruin all their stuff that they keep down there.
Right.
And second of all, the houses all end up falling into the hole because if everyone's got a basement, that becomes one big hole.
Yeah.
And over time, the foundations collapse.
Yes. Yes. No, I have no reason whatsoever to doubt what you're saying. And he says that, you know, I can't quite understand the principle, but you end up with your house being perched on stilts. You know, whilst the rest of the rest of the home is well, it's just vacant, so to speak, this huge gap. Anyway, point of my story is, it reminded me of an old colleague of ours, Matthew Wright. You obviously know Matthew, and he went on from being the showbiz reporter at The Sun to became a TV star, and he did the show which preceded the one I do now, Jeremy Vine on Five. It was called The
Right. What happened to Matthew Wright? He went off the radar, didn't he?
Well, I was going to say quite a lot of things happened. You know, Matthew decided on a new career direction. He left TV and went to radio, started working for Talk Radio, had a very good show there and all that kind of stuff. But I do remember the issue of basements with Matthew Wright. Matthew Wright lived in a very nice part of town. I'm not sure where it was, I have to say. I don't know. But for 2 years, one of his neighbours was having a basement dug out, okay? And for 2 years, he said he was tormented by the constant drilling and the noise of, you know, people working, the nuisance value of lorries in the street and all this kind of stuff. And he said it would go on all round the clock. They didn't stop at 5 o'clock in the evening. You know what I mean? He said it was awful. And you'd have thought that if that kind of level of nuisance was being imposed upon you by one of your neighbours, you'd have every right to go to the local authority and say, this has got to stop. And he tried it many, many times and it never happened. Because when you live in a neighbourhood where there are lots of wealthy people and they're influential and they're famous and all that, it's very hard to get an order against them.
Backhanders.
Well, I'm not saying it's backhanders, but it changed his life. I mean, it literally nearly drove him mad, you know what I mean? And whether or not that coincided with his career change, I don't know. But anyway, look, it's just, you're absolutely right. Why would you want to dig under your house? At any time you think, oh, this could fall in, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, and basements are pretty dangerous things.
Yeah, they are.
In all kinds of ways.
I totally agree.
I lived in a house in Dulwich where we had a small basement. It had been there since Victorian times because it had a coal hole. So when they used to have coal fires, the truck would come round or horse and cart, whatever it was, and they would deliver the bags of coal and they'd take a lid off a sort of a hole at the front step and chuck the coal down into the coal hole underneath the house.
Yeah.
But of course, the coal holes link to the sewers.
Yeah.
And the rats come in through the sewers. Oh, so they're getting in underneath the houses through the coal holes.
Yeah, that's always
worried. We had rats in our cellar because of that.
God, that's always worried me about, you know.
So, you know, basement, no thanks. I'd rather be in a penthouse like you.
I totally agree. You dig down into the ground. You never know what's going to come up. Have you ever had any dealings with Jeremy Clarkson?
Never have. No, I quite like watching him on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, as he pronounces it.
Yeah.
I saw him on Jonathan Ross the other night. Did you? Oh, yeah.
No, I didn't, no.
Yeah, he was on with Sting, and everything that Jeremy Clarkson said that everyone else thought was hysterically funny, Sting just sat there deeply unimpressed. There must be some history between those two.
Well, what are you doing on his show then?
Well, it wasn't Jeremy's show. It was Jonathan Ross's show.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. And there were two guests. Yeah.
You've got half a dozen guests. Got Gary Barlow there. Got that woman.
Lineup, isn't it? Eh?
Yeah. Who was that woman? Oh, you know, the one who sings, the Northern girl. You like her. I don't particularly rate her.
Not Adele, no.
Sheridan Smith.
Oh, Sheridan Smith. Yeah, she was in a car crash. Have you read that?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's been in a car crash.
In a Range Rover.
In a Range Rover. And whenever you read about, oh, dear me, you know, actors, actresses in car crashes, you think, oh, I hope they haven't had an unfortunate sort of incident or something like that. You know what I mean?
Well, she was being very flirtatious with Gary Barlow, who they've got a single out. Of course they have. A Christmas single. Yeah. And I found it a little bit cringy, actually.
Really?
But, yeah, Jeremy Clarkson's talking all about his pigs and his cows and his... He's got this new Largo, which is fantastically successful. And Sting sits there and just goes, well, I've got a vineyard at my estate in Italy, as if a vineyard is better than, you know, having a your own Largo, which is selling out and making you a fortune.
Yeah. Not bad, though, for a bloke who used to be a milkman in North Shields, in the northeast of England, you know, old Sting.
Well, he was a teacher, wasn't he, at one point?
He was a teacher, but at one stage, you know, he must have a holiday job or something as a milkman or something like that. But...
His wife, Trudy, threw me out of their house once.
Really? What happened?
I had done an interview with them about 3 years previously.
Yeah.
And then another interview was lined up. And instead of them saying to the PR, oh, we don't like her, she wrote a piece for the Daily Mail that we didn't really like, so we don't want her to come round again. Trudy Styler got me round to their house in Highgate, which is Yehudi Menuhin's old house.
Oh, yeah.
And the door was opened by one of those Brazilian Amazon people, you know, and native people that wear the big plate in their bottom lip.
Yeah, that's right,
You know, so barefoot and with kind of the straw skirt on and all of this, and brought me tea in a china cup. And then I was shown into this room and I had to sit there and wait about half an hour for Trudy.
Right.
And then all these other people with plates in their mouths all shuffled in and sort of stood around like a Greek chorus.
Ah.
And she proceeded to tear me off a strip, and she was brandishing the copy of the Daily Mail where I'd written the piece that she didn't like.
Golly.
So she humiliated me in front of all these people and then kicked me out.
Well,
and I remember walking back down the road to my car, and I was so shocked that I started to cry, which is not like me.
No, it's not.
And then I had to ring the editor and say, I'm really sorry, I didn't get the interview because Trudy kicked me out.
Mm.
And I ended up writing a piece about what happened, actually.
Brilliant.
So I got my own back.
At least when you said that, you know, she assailed you and all that, I thought you were going to say she forced a plate into your mouth.
I'd like to have seen her try.
Right.
I tell you where, I would have shoved her plate.
But anyway, getting back to Clarkson, I just admire Clarkson so much. He has the attitude of being so laid back, and yet he's so successful at everything he does. You know,
he really is.
He started
to be him.
Beer, and that became, you know, a world famous show. So world famous that he managed to get a contract for $100 million to take it on to other TV networks after he fell out with the BBC. And by the way, he fell out with the BBC in the sort of circumstances you and I would recognise very well. He's out on location somewhere. They've finished the day's shooting, back to the hotel. Jeremy gets fed up that there's no steak, apparently, in the restaurant. And allegedly, although he's, you know, holding his hands up to it, whacks a producer who he said, you know, should have been in charge of getting everything together at the end of the day shooting to make sure he had some decent food. And that led to him leaving the BBC, and the rest is history. But no, what I'm saying is he then moved on to other things. He's then got Jeremy Clarkson's farm. That's very successful. And you just mentioned lager. He's now started brewing his own lager, and there's an absolute huge demand for it. He has them going to overdrive production to supply people for Christmas with his lager.
And he's got a new book out called Diddly Squat, the story of his farm and his empire. So, you know, Sting can think what he likes, but Jeremy's doing very well. I read that even his ex-wife wishes that she hadn't kicked him out after he had an affair.
Oh, right. Because he's now still being successful without her, you mean?
Yeah, I guess so, but he's moved on. He's with a new wife called Lisa now, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he is, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Now,
good for him. We like Jeremy.
Yeah, I like Jeremy. Of course, he had a very long feud with Piers Morgan. They ended up punching each other at an awards ceremony.
Yes, they did. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah,
but you see, when you get two egos like that, and they are two gigantic egos, and that is like two cars crashing into each other. One's going 60, the other one's going 60. The impact speed is 120 miles.
That's right.
That is always going to be fireworks, isn't
it? Yeah, sure. No, I totally agree.
Because they recognise in each other the things that they loathe about themselves.
Yeah, No, I don't know. Yeah, I think you're probably right. A bit more serious a story here, but nevertheless a great story. Sir Frank Williams has died. It won't be a household name to everybody, but this guy literally was a giant of the Formula One motor racing world. He created a team, Williams, which is the second most successful in the history of motor racing after only Ferrari. And Ferrari haven't been that successful in recent years. So you're talking about, you know, the fact that he got as good as Ferrari in a few years. An amazing man, an engineer, an entrepreneur, a businessman, but who really could have given it all up when he crashed a hired car. He'd hired a Ford Sierra to get back to the airport in 1985 from a test site at the Paul Ricard circuit in Nice. And he went round a bend too fast and admits that, you know, it was poor driving on my behalf. Car rolled. He was badly injured, broke his neck and became, I think, a tetraplegic for the rest of his life. But nevertheless, kept on running one of the world's most successful racing teams. I've just got huge respect for a bloke like that.
It's a horrible irony as well, isn't it? When you make a living from the fastest vehicles on Earth.
Yes.
Apart from aeroplanes. Well, they're not on Earth, I suppose. So it is the fastest on Earth. And then you go and crash a Ford Anglia or whatever it was.
Ford Sierra, yeah.
Ford Sierra. It's such a shame.
Oh, terrible.
But, you know, all power to him because he just, as you say, kept on. And he was 90-something, wasn't he, when he died?
Yeah, I think 89, I think he was.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. But nevertheless, I saw an interview with him a few years ago and somebody said, you know, what difference did it make to the progress you made as running your Williams Formula One racing team for the fact that for the last, you know, 20 years you've had to do it in a wheelchair? He said, utterly irrelevant. He said, my determination and grit never wavered whether I'm in this chair or not. And I thought, God, I couldn't be like that if it happened to me. You know,
well, do you know what? To a much lesser extent, although I'm not undermining what happened, when my father fell under a train and he lost his arm, and he never stopped writing. He was working for The Independent at the time, and he did not miss one column. I used to go into the hospital. Yeah. He would dictate his column to me. I wrote it down in a notebook, used to go home and dictate it over the phone to the copy takers. Nobody realised that he'd had an accident and lost his arm. He carried on travelling around the world, covering fights and big sporting events.
Yeah.
And he carried on driving. He had a little device that he used to put on the steering wheel so that he could power steer any car,
right.
You know, a rental car in any country in the world.
Yeah.
And he just soldiered on. And I think that is the answer to not going mad. You've got to not feel sorry for yourself and you've got to soldier on, whatever it is.
Yeah. No, I just have so much admiration for people like that. You know, some people get hits in life and bang, it's all over. But others, if they're determined, they go and do it. Now, of course, we're into the drinking season, Miss Jones. Well, you know, you could say that most of our life has been the drinking season. I haven't been from Fleet Street. But,
open season. It's never closed, is it?
Yeah, but what about this headline here? Britons lose their taste for supersized wine glasses. And apparently now we're all going into pubs and asking for just a normal measure and we're buying glasses at, you know, Harrods, you mentioned earlier, of the smaller variety and all this kind of stuff. I never order anything except a large glass of Pinot Grigio or a large glass of Merlot. I wouldn't dream, because I'd feel, you know, embarrassed, to order a glass of small wine.
Ah, well, there is science to this. This depends on the colour of the wine you order.
Excuse me.
If it's red, the bigger the glass, the better, as the wine warms in your hands and it becomes chambrade as you sit there nursing it. So you want it nice and warm so that the flavour comes out and you enjoy it. If it's white or rosé, you want it to stay as cold as possible. So it's better to have a smaller glass and to either replenish it frequently or to keep ordering more and more glasses of white wine or rosé.
Right.
So you don't want a great big glass of white wine, because by the time you get halfway down, it's going to be all warmed up and it's going to taste like sick.
Right. Oh, dear. That doesn't sound good, does it? nevertheless, I feel that if I don't serve somebody a big glass of wine, either, you know, if I'm in the seat, so to speak, or if somebody comes around here, as they might do at Christmas, they're going to get a large glass of wine in my house, because I can't stand, you know, the, I don't know what it is, the parsimonious nature of people who just pour, you know, 2 inches of wine into a glass.
Maybe, yeah, I agree. So yeah. The thing is, with white, you know, if you're in a pub, just buy them a bottle and ask the bartender to keep it cold behind the bar for you.
Yeah, well, maybe. What about?
Or do what we do and have gigantic gins and tonics.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Just get them down your throat. So how about this? Men are more blinded by beauty than women, a study has confirmed. Well, why bother having a study? Of course, men are more likely to be dazzled by the beauty of a woman than a woman is to be dazzled by the beauty of a man. What a ridiculous sort of survey.
Ah, well, there is science behind this one as well. The most confident masculine men among us do not need a shallow beauty on their arm to make them look good.
Right.
Men who are confident and very masculine look for other qualities in a woman, such as intelligence, kindness, honesty, generosity, a maternal instinct, an interest in the world around them and a sense of the bigger picture of life, a homemaker's instinct, and a desire to create a comfortable home. You see, men who are very confident in their own skins don't need her to be pretty. If she is, that's a bonus, but it's not the most important thing. Whereas less confident men need to look good among other men, so they need the pretty one.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's all a bit too psychologically damaging for me, that. I like beautiful women.
You just
women.
Go for the pretty one.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I like beautiful women. Why not? You know, great, you know, a beautiful woman, a pretty woman. You know, my eyes light up and I feel great about it. So there we are. I like all women. Of course I do. But if they're particularly beautiful, then that's particularly good. Right, Ms. Jones, that's it for another Life on Planet Porky. I want to thank everybody out there for listening once again. Thank you. And Ms. Jones, I hope you're going to have a great few days ahead until we get together again around a microphone and produce the next Life on Planet Porky. I made my amends. I got a kilt sent to me by a fine kilt maker in Scotland called McGregor and McDuff. Thank you very much indeed to them for helping me out there. I hope I got that right.
I'm sure it wasn't Ben Doon and Phil McCavity.
Oh, no, come on, Miss Jones. For goodness sake. A, we are a family show. And
that's
B,
just names, right? And, I mean, and, that is just names.
And B... B, right, we are not going to, you know, sort of start taking the mickey out of all things Scottish. It's outrageous.
I'm not taking the mickey. I wouldn't dream of taking the mickey.
I would hope not as well.
So what happened next?
Hang on, I hope they've got the name of the...
I'm feeding you the lines here.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just checking that I've told you properly the name of the kilt makers.
And I remember walking back down the road to my car and I was so shocked that I started to cry, which is not like me.
No, it's not like you, no.
And then I had to ring the editor and say, I'm really sorry, I didn't get the interview because Trudy kicked me out. Mm. And I ended up writing a piece about what happened, actually.
Brilliant.
So I got my own back.
At least when you said that, you know, she assailed you and all that, I thought you were going to say she forced a plate into your mouth.
Yeah. I'd like to have seen her try. Yeah, right. I tell you where I would have shoved her plate.
Yeah. Now, old Damon Blur, okay? He
Damon Blur. Damon Blur of Albarn, you mean?
Sorry, yeah, thank you very much. Damon Albarn of Blur. I've been to his bar, by the way, in Iceland.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows how to help you save. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select Whirlpool kitchen appliances. Plus, get an additional 10% off when you buy two or three select major appliances. And when you buy four or more, you'll save an additional 20%. Find the right appliances and features that fit your kitchen's unique needs and style. Shop Whirlpool 4th of July deals at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long-term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.